Next case for argument is United States versus Lee. Mr. McKenzie.
May it please the court, I'm Ashawn McKenzie, a law student from Notre Dame, under the supervision of Bob Palmer. We've been appointed to represent the defendant in this case, Jermaine Lee. When unconstitutional means are used to elicit a criminal defendant's confession, the defendant's constitutional rights have been violated, and such a confession should be excluded from evidence. In this case, the district court erred in admitting Lee's confession. First, the evidence at the suppression hearing did not indicate that Lee understood his rights in signing the waiver form. Second, the evidence did show that the interrogating officers used impermissible tactics which overbore Mr. Lee's will. Third, the interrogating officers asked Lee incriminating questions before giving him his Miranda rights. And finally, there is a reasonable possibility that the evidence may have contributed to Lee's conviction.
This was a court trial, not a jury trial.
Correct.
The judge, in making the final decision here, said he was relying on evidence other than the statement made by the defendant.
Well,
is that correct?
Well, not exactly. What the court says is that it felt that the government had proved his case without regard to that evidence, but it does not expressly state that it has not regarded that evidence. It simply suggests that there was other evidence upon which it may have been able to base its decision. But the standard here is the harmless error standard. Under this standard, it must be apparent that the evidence complained of, or if there's any possibility that the evidence complained of might have contributed to the conviction, that will prevent a finding of harmless error. So this places the duty upon the government.
Beyond a reasonable doubt, is that your position?
Yes. I'm sorry, I'm not sure I completely heard you.
I say, is your position that the standard is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
That's correct. And that's because these are constitutional violations rather than a mere trial error. Once again, this places the burden upon the government to prove that that it appears beyond a reasonable doubt that the evidence complained of did not contribute to the verdict obtained.
Well, suppose the judge said beyond a reasonable doubt, this is my view, and I've disregarded this evidence.
I believe
in that. Harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
I believe in that case it would be. In addition, although
he didn't use those words, though, so you're questioning whether he took that position. Is that correct?
Correct. It's not clear from what the statements of the trial court that the evidence did not contribute, and that there was no possibility that it contributed. Now, once again, if there's even the possibility that it, a reasonable possibility that it might have contributed, that prevents a finding of harmless error. In the absence of that, the government must prove that the other evidence in the case against the defendant was overwhelming. In this case, the government has not argued that the other evidence was overwhelming. And to speak plainly, the other evidence is not overwhelming. This case is very similar to another Seventh Circuit case, Dudley versus Duckworthy. In this case, it involved an admission of evidence at trial which violated the defendant's Fourth Amendment rights. In this case, two witnesses of the 32 who testified, only really two witnesses implicated the defendant in the crime charged. The court noted that these two witnesses were inherently dubious as they were admitted accomplices testifying in exchange for immunity or dismissal of their charges. In addition, the court noted that the strength of their sometimes conflicting testimony did not rise to the level of required to render the error harmless. The court notes that although the the evidence was impressive. It was not overwhelming. Now, I would submit that this case is very similar to the case we have here with Lee. Lee's case rests really upon the testimony of two or three witnesses. Each of them were also charged with loosely related crimes. In addition, these witnesses were inherently dubious as they were each testifying for some sort of favorable treatment from the government. Specifically, the main witness in the government's case was testifying in order to help out the father of her her minor children. These things make Lee's case similar. In addition, there exists a reasonable possibility that the disputed evidence might have contributed to Lee's conviction. First, in count two against Lee, this count two depends primarily upon a video recording of a controlled by. The participant in the video, the participant's face is not shown in the video. The court notes that it makes a decision upon the identity of the person in the video based upon comparing the voice in the video with Mr. Lee's voice. It's a reasonable possibility that hearing Mr. Lee's recorded voice during his hour and 15-minute taped confession might have contributed to the court's finding that the voice in the recording of count two was also Mr. Lee's voice. Second, it's a reasonable possibility that hearing Mr. Lee being called a liar repeatedly and being forced to change his testimony during the course of his interrogation contributed to the court's finding or determination of Mr. Lee's credibility during trial. Credibility was an issue in this case, and the court decided that to find Mr. Lee uncredible and the other witnesses credible. In addition, during the course of Lee's interrogation, he's testifying about the different people involved, the different transactions he was involved in. Hearing Mr. Lee testify about all these things and comparing his testimony at trial, it's a reasonable possibility that hearing those things contributed to Lee's conviction. Now, let's talk for a few moments about the actual constitutional violations, starting first with Mr. Lee's waiver. Now, an accused person is guaranteed the right to remain silent and to have counsel present during any questioning. A valid waiver of these rights requires a knowing and intelligent act done with sufficient awareness of the relevant circumstances and likely consequences, requiring that the defendant grasp the basic concept that he has the right to refuse to speak to the police, that he has a right to counsel, and that if he does speak to the police, what he says can be used against him. Now, the government bears a heavy burden in showing that the defendant executed a knowing and voluntary waiver. In this, the government must show that the defendant was advised of his rights, understood his rights, and then voluntarily relinquished those rights. And as the Supreme Court points out, there's a strong presumption against waiver of the constitutional right to counsel, and there's a serious and weighty responsibility upon the trial judge in making the determination whether or not a person's waiver is intelligent. Now, this places a positive duty upon the interrogating officers to inquire into this before going into questioning. In this case, in Lee's case, the interrogating officers fail in this duty. They ask no questions. There's nothing
there
to show.
There is a certain awkwardness, though. You wouldn't give the warnings before you ask the person his name, would you?
No, but they do ask several incriminating questions before ever getting around to the Miranda warnings. They ask Mr. Lee questions about his drug usage, his finances, money he may have in a safe deposit box. And ultimately, they ask him about his drug affiliates. And Mr. Lee is convicted on a conspiracy count. Now, finding out about Mr. Lee's drug affiliates and drug associates prior to reading him his Miranda rights and obtaining his waiver would be in violation, and in fact was in violation of Mr. Lee's rights.
But they didn't use those particular answers in the trial, did they?
Not specifically, but what the concern here with the two-step interrogation is that the defendant will feel as if the cat's already out of the bag, and that the defendant won't invoke his constitutional rights. And that's exactly what we have here. We have a situation in which the cat's already out of the bag. Mr. Lee's answered these questions, and now they're continuing on. There are no curative steps shown or taken that would help indicate to Mr. Lee that the prior questionings couldn't be used against him, or that his prior statements couldn't be used. So in that, we come right down to the main concern in this regard. In speaking of the two-step interrogation, now this court has not yet decided upon which test that it will use, but there exists both an intent-based test as well as a defendant-based test. And I submit to the court that Mr. Lee's interrogation fails under both of them. Under the intent-based test, it must be shown that the police intended to deliberately.
Your time has expired, Mr.
I'm sorry. My
we'll give
expired.
You a minute later, though.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye. So thank you. And Mr. Hartzler?
Good morning. I'd like to begin by clarifying our position on the standard of review. We were responding to a brief that argued there was no harmless error. This is clearly a harmless error case, and to the extent that that's not clear in our brief, I hope to make it clear now. The problem, the difference between the two sides is that opposing counsel suggests that there are two avenues once we step into the realm of harmless error review, and one is you evaluate it depending on whether it's a constitutional error versus a trial error. I don't believe that the Supreme Court cases or this court cases would really support that theory. Our position is that there are indeed two avenues that you would pursue or consider in harmless error analysis, but the dividing point or the decision, the difference is between a jury trial and a bench trial. And in a bench trial, error, prejudicial error, is not dismissed as unimportant, but it has less, prejudicial impact than it might have on a jury. So in the realm of harmless error analysis, you're always evaluating the magnitude of the prejudice of the error versus the strength of the evidence. Well, the magnitude of an error of this sort in a bench trial is exceedingly small. Let me step back to talk about for a moment the argument that has just been made that the judge might have been influenced by having heard this confession and so concluded that the same name, same voice, pardon me, that was used during the confession was the voice that was on the tape that supports count two in the indictment. Following this argument that the judge is influenced by having heard the confession. Well, that argument doesn't work because the judge heard the confession during the pretrial suppression hearing. So the analysis would be that, well, if a judge has heard suppression, the defendant's voice during the suppression hearing, the judge might be influenced during the trial. And, of course, then it wouldn't matter whether the evidence was suppressed or not. But in this case, the evidence was obviously not suppressed. It was used, but it was harmless for a variety of reasons, one of which, of course, was the judge, although didn't explicitly disavow it, made it very clear that he did not consider it in finding the evidence proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I think the word that he used the second time around was, this result accrues with completely disregarding the confession. And that makes sense in this case.
I'm concerned about these two stage interrogations, first without the Miranda warnings and then with. Isn't that troublesome?
I thought the testimony was sloppy. The real problem is that it's not in the record as to what was asked from the second page. The second page of the personal information form. Clearly, they can ask booking information, as someone here suggested. They'd ask you, Your Honor, suggested. They can ask the name and serial number and rank, things of that sort, before they advise the defendant of the Miranda warning. And you'll see that the second witness at the suppression hearing, I think, described those initial biographical questions as having been asked prior to Miranda. Then it was the third witness, Sergeant Gorsuch, who testified regarding what is on the second page. And the second page, I would say, is, what's the legal term, problematic. I mean, drug associates, drug usage. But there's no indication in the record that those questions were answered or that they elicited any incriminating evidence. So you really have a very bad record to evaluate the use of that personal history report. There was a suggestion that they may have been, those questions may have been asked. In fact, I've seen the second page, and it's actually worse than what's in the record. But I don't think that it really creates a problem in this case for the reason I said. One, the officers didn't testify they got any incriminating evidence. And two, Mr. Lee himself testified. I mean, he didn't say that when he was interrogated, they asked these highly incriminating questions. So there really is no evidence that there was any elicitation of that kind of incriminating evidence. Whether or not the form should be used to its completion, whether they should turn to the second page, or at least the second half of the second page, beyond family member information, you're absolutely right. It's problematic. I don't think there has been a case before this court where that second page has arisen. And if you don't mind my going off the record, I don't think there will be one, because I believe the form will be changed when they meet this Wednesday about it. So there may be some benefit from having raised it in this case, because that information is floated on to the Illinois State Police, and I think we'll benefit from having it raised in this case. But I don't believe that the court should be troubled in this case for the very reason that there wasn't really that classic two-step interrogation where they've elicited incriminating information that we have on the record and then advised of Miranda rights and followed up with eliciting the same information. There's just no indication that happened whatsoever here. I want to point out one other thing. First of all, to the extent that the government does not argue that the evidence is overwhelming, we do that because we don't really think we need to argue that it's overwhelming. It clearly was overwhelming. The judge found that the main two witnesses were credible, the three cooperating witnesses were credible, and the defendant was not. And the judge doesn't need to rely on voice identification for any of the audio tapes. The witness testified that the person she was meeting with was Mr. Lee, and she was determined to be credible. So you have not only witnesses who testify regarding the drug transactions, but you have three of the transactions that were charged in the three substantive counts corroborated by audio and video. I also wanted to point out one other reason that's not in our brief as to why this is not going to be harmless. I think if you look on page 4 of the reply brief, there's some indication that this evidence would not have come in. That is, the confession evidence could not have come in the trial. But that's not true. The defendant himself testified, and he brought it out in his opening statement. It came in as substantive evidence. We could have the government could have cross-examined him with the statement. He brought the statement out and admitted to it in his testimony. Now, he didn't have to do that. He could have testified and asked that the scope of the cross-examination be limited, maybe only to challenge his credibility, but not to introduce the evidence substantively. So I'm not sure where you're going to find any harmfulness here, where the defendant himself took the witness stand and presented or addressed the statement himself, in addition, of course, to the fact that the evidence was really overwhelming. I don't think, by the way, you need to reach the overwhelming question, because as Your Honor has indicated, it's a bench trial. So not that the standard would be any lower, it's just that the evaluation of the prejudice is going to be different than it would be with a jury. The judge found that there was evidence beyond a reasonable doubt without considering the confession. I think that's the clearest, most direct route to resolving this appeal. There are no further questions.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Hartzler. And Mr. McKenzie, do you have anything further? Okay, we'll give you a minute.
To address some things very quickly. First, as far as this being a bench trial, when the standard was announced in Fahey versus State of Connecticut from the Supreme Court. That case was also a bench trial, in which the court notes that as a constitutional error, it was concerned with much more than whether or not there was substantial or sufficient evidence, but whether or not the evidence was overwhelming. So that is the correct standard. And as far as the two-step interrogation goes, the government suggests that since it's not on the record what Mr. Lee's answers were to these questions, that we shouldn't worry about them. But once again, the concern is that the defendant will feel as if the cat is out of the bag. The focus is on the defendant, not what evidence we have exactly on the record that comes from this. The focus is that the defendant will feel as if the cat is out of the bag. Now, it's reasonable to infer that as Mr. Lee answered all the other questions asked to him by the officers, that he would answer these other questions. And I see that my time is gone, but should the court have no other questions?
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. McKenzie, and we thank you and Notre Dame for accepting the appointment and for your vigorous efforts on behalf of your client.
Thank you.